I next met with Dr. Anas Younes, and to begin, we discussed recent progress in Hodgkin's lymphoma.
There's two or maybe three agents or class of agents are very exciting for Hodgkin lymphomas. The first one, which is the leading compound, is the SGN35 because it just completed a pivotal trial, and this is an antibody-drug conjugate. The second class is mTOR inhibitors, and the data coming very nice from everolimus, which is oral mTOR inhibitor. Small number of patients, yes, but the response rate is about 50%, which is remarkable in heavily pretreated patients. So there's now a large phase 2 trial trying to duplicate or confirm the small trial that came from Mayo Clinic. And if this proves to be correct, then this is a major news that needs to be confirmed in a pivotal trial also too. And the other class of agents is making news and relapse Hodgkin lymphoma, the HDAC inhibitors. And there's several of them in phase 1, phase 2 trials for relapse Hodgkin lymphoma.
Now, are any of these agents being thought about in the upfront setting or just a recurrent setting?
Right, good question. So, you know, the first step is to seek potential approval in the relapse setting as single agent because of unmet medical need. But the natural development would be to combine it with other active regimens, either in the frontline setting or at first relapse before transplant. Keep in mind that safety issue is important for Hodgkin lymphoma because these are young individuals, so you want to be careful when you combine these agents in upfront settings. But the first phase 1 trial that is combining SGN35 with a standard regimen of ABVD is started enrolling patients. Hopefully, if this proves to be safe and effective, it may change the treatment paradigm of Hodgkin lymphoma.
Anything new in understanding why some patients aren't cured with Hodgkin?
But that's a question can be asked for all types of cancers. There are clearly lack of knowledge about what makes cancer cell resistant to what we have right now. But hopefully with all these new molecular data and sequencing and so forth, we'll gain more insights about why some tumors are more resistant to specific drugs, and we will move more and more towards personalized cancer therapy. So when we figure out why a certain tumor is more resistant to regimen A but not B, then we would give them regimen B and so forth.
What kind of trials are going on right now in Hodgkin's disease, and specifically any, you know, larger phase 3 studies, or is it almost all studies of new agents in the phase 1-2 setting?
So there are several phase 3 trials, but in the absence of new treatments, most of these phase 3 trials are focusing on reduced toxicity of what we have. So for example, for early stage Hodgkin lymphoma, we're using PET scan to guide the decisions about the number of ABVD cycles you use. You can go down to 2 cycles or 4 cycles plus minus radiation therapy. We also have a large randomized trial adding rituximab to ABVD, comparing it to ABVD alone. This is based on a phase 2 trial from our group showing that if you add rituximab with the idea of depleting reactive B lymphocytes in the microenvironment, you can make the cancer cells more sensitive to ABVD chemotherapy. So this is a larger scale randomized trial. There's another randomized trial in early stage Hodgkin lymphoma going on in Europe. Same thing, comparing ABVD plus rituximab with ABVD plus radiation therapy. The question is, can we substitute radiation therapy with a less toxic drug like rituximab?
Anything new in terms of the pathophysiology, in terms of what's actually going on, particularly in the stroma? My understanding is, you know, in this disease, it's not packed with tumor cells. There's a lot of stroma. What do we know about the interaction between the stroma and the tumor cells?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. So this is a very unusual cancer because the percentage of cancer cells, usually at least in the newly diagnosed patients, comprise less than 5% of the entire tumor mass. 80 to 95% of the cells are reactive inflammatory cells, are benign and malignant. And that shows you that the cancer cells, in at least in Hodgkin lymphoma, are completely dependent on their growth and survival on the microenvironment. If you take the cancer cell out of the microenvironment and try to establish cell lines, it's almost impossible. There's only about 12 Hodgkin lymphoma cell lines that are floating around worldwide, and probably only 4 of them are of true origin from Reed-Sternberg cells. The rest of them are like of questionable origin. So they're completely dependent on the microenvironment. The question is, what is in the microenvironment that is specific, that is providing these growth and survival signals that we can target therapeutically? We're still learning about this. Some people suspect that CD40 ligand and BLIS, BAF, CD40 ligand, and other cytokines, but we don't know the exact molecular mechanism responsible for the interaction between the microenvironment and the cancer cells that specifically enhance the growth.
Now, you've been involved with a number of publications, including an important sort of guidelines paper with Bernard Coffier and JCO of tumor lysis syndrome. This is something we haven't talked a lot about on this series, but as I look through your work, there's a lot of stuff going on there. Can you kind of go through the background and where we are right now with this?
Right. So tumor lysis syndrome is not a common syndrome that we see, but it's frequently lethal sometimes, and especially in its extreme form. Up till recently, we really did not have much of a prophylactic treatment that is effective for this syndrome. All we used is allopurinol, aggressive hydration, and so forth. So with the presence of new agents that is more effective, then it became more an issue. When do you use these agents? Some of them are relatively expensive. What are the guidelines to use these agents? Sort of like G-CSF and the growth factors, so forth. So that's led to the development of sort of guidelines. When do you use hydration alone, observation? When do you use simple agents like allopurinol? And when do you use the more expensive agent like rasburocase?
Can you explain exactly what rasburocase is?
So the difference between allopurinol and rasburocase, allopurinol inhibits new formation of uric acid. It has no effect on preformed or pre-existing uric acid, whereas rasburocase breaks down pre-existing uric acid to more soluble, water-soluble form.
And this is an enzyme?
It is a recombinant enzyme, that's correct.
Can you go through specifically in terms of the clinical situations where, you know, this syndrome should be considered and basically kind of track through the algorithm?
Right. So again, same thing what happened with guidelines for growth factors. This is my favorite analogy, is that you can't treat everyone prophylactically just because you get chemotherapy. So you have to come up with a group of patients who are at high risk for, let's say, neutropenic fever or complications of neutropenia. And then those patients would be eligible for prophylactic use of growth factor support. And the same thing here with the rasburocase. So we needed to identify the patients at high risk of tumor lysis so these patients can be given prophylactic doses of rasburocase. And that's not that difficult because there's a lot of literature to suggest who are the patients who are at high risk for tumor lysis syndrome. And these are mainly the patients with rapidly proliferating malignancies like lymphoblastic lymphoma, ALL, Burkitt's lymphomas, and some types of aggressive large B-cell lymphomas and acute leukemias with high blood cell counts. So these are candidates for primary prophylaxis with rasburocase. And those who are not at risk for a tumor lysis or low risk, that they don't need that, you don't need to worry about them, you can treat them in an outpatient setting, the low-grade follicular lymphomas, the Hodgkin lymphomas, these almost never have tumor lysis. You don't need to worry about those patients. And there's a group in between, the gray zone, which is difficult to sort out, but this may be candidate for secondary prophylaxis. Once they have the tumor lysis, you need to be aware of it and treat it aggressively.
What is the effective way to sort of monitor for tumor lysis syndrome from a laboratory perspective?
Right. So there are four laboratory abnormalities that are associated with tumor lysis syndrome. The elevation of uric acid, which is the standard one, but then you can have high potassium, high phosphorus, and low calcium. So there's four different parameters. If you have two out of these four, is adequate to call you have tumor lysis syndrome.
You mentioned diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. What specific clinical situation do you look for there? Is it the LDH? Is it the amount of tumor? What about the patient's age, renal function? How do you bring all these things together?
Right. So right now, we look at the diffuse large B-cell lymphoma as intermediate risk. It's not automatic indication to use primary prophylaxis. But you're right. I mean, we look at different parameters within the individual patient. So patient with bulky disease, let's say 15-centimeter abdominal mass, was very high LDH, borderline or slightly elevated BUN creatinine, an older gentleman, this patient would be admitted to the hospital to get inpatient induction chemotherapy, for example, R-CHOP. I would watch this patient very carefully, and at the earliest sign that there may be tumor lysis or elevation of uric acid or elevation of potassium, I would err on the conservative side and give them rasburocase with the aggressive hydration, of course, and monitoring of the input and output of fluids.
How effective is LDH monitoring, for example, in a situation like that? If the LDH is normal, is that enough that you really don't have to worry that much about it?
By itself, no, because again, the issue is that when you give the chemotherapy, this could change dramatically. So if the tumor is very sensitive, even though you're starting with low LDH or borderline LDH, it may increase significantly with the breakdown of the tissues.
So, for example, and actually John Leonard presented an older patient with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma with big abdominal mass. And, you know, I was just kind of thinking about in that patient, there was a normal LDH. So again, is that enough of a reason to maybe not worry about it? Or are there sort of less aggressive maneuvers than, say, Rasbura case that might be considered in a patient like that?
Yeah. So it's unusual to have someone with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma with bulky abdominal mass and normal LDH. But even though, let's say, that patient existed, I would look at the other parameters, at the patient's age, if there's underlying cardiac or pulmonary disease, if they have borderline BUN creatinine. I always err on the conservative side because you don't want to lose a patient for tumor lysis, especially if they have potentially curable cancer.
What about the administration of Rasbura case? How is it done? What kind of side effects and toxicities have been seen?
Right. So the Rasbura case is a very unusual drug that is used in oncology because most of the times in a patient's lifetime is used once. It's different from, let's say, growth factor support, where you use it with every cycle repeatedly. The reason why is that because patients, if they are going to have tumor lysis, they usually have it with the first cycle. They almost never have it after cycle two or three. Now, they may have tumor lysis if they have relapsed disease with bulky parameters and so forth. Yeah, they may need another treatment. But if for curable cancers like the Burkitt's lymphomas, large lymphomas, most of the patients will require it only once in their lifetime. That's why I'm always in favor of erring on the conservative side. Now, having said that, the treatment is simple. Usually, you give it once per day, and you monitor the uric acid, which is almost always, 99.9% of the times, it will normalize, go down almost to zero within 4 hours. And you repeat the uric acid usually in the following day. If there is a rapid re-increase in the uric acid, you may need to give the patient a second cycle. But in the average situation, we have a patient with not a unusual, rapidly proliferating Burkitt's lymphomas or ALL. The average adult person would require 2 doses only.
Now, one of the issues actually that came up in this paper that you wrote, I guess the paper brought up the issue of putting people in the ICU for monitoring, and there was a letter that kind of came in response to that saying, do you do that for every Burkitt's patient? Can you talk a little bit about that issue?
Right. You can see that the guidelines are still emerging, so there's some disagreements between even experts, mainly because the incidence of tumor lysis is not very high. So the experience can vary between different individuals, different countries, and so forth. My own experience, I don't admit patients prophylactically for tumor lysis. We watch them like a hawk on the floor, aggressive hydrations, input and output. We call renal consult to be aware of the situation just in case if it's needed. And we give primary prophylaxis with rasburocase and watch them. Now, if there's an increased laboratory parameters that suggests that ongoing tumor lysis, then yes, sometimes you may have to transfer the patient for the ICU for monitoring, for dialysis, and so forth. But it's not a routine indication to admit the patient to the ICU.
And I take it there's some patients with, for example, Burkitt's, where you won't actually treat them preventively, or do you treat everybody?
I treat everyone with Burkitt's lymphoma preventively.
Another area that I heard tumor lysis syndrome mentioned recently that I thought was kind of interesting that I hadn't really thought about was the use of lenalidomide in CLL. What do we know about that?
Well, there's some case reports about tumor lysis associated with lenalidomide and also fludarabine in CLL, a disease that we don't think of it as a high risk for tumor lysis. So the risk for tumor lysis is not only dependent on the underlying type of tumor, but also on the treatment itself. So that's what makes sometimes it difficult to predict.
You know, lenalidomide's always kind of been a mystery to me to try to figure out how it actually works, you know. And when I heard about this, as a matter of fact, I think it was Myron Chuchman who talked about the fact that he'd seen people who got lenalidomide with CLL, and after like 3 tablets, you know, they started to have tumor lysis, and there was this exquisite sensitivity, and I guess there's the issue of dose. What's been your experience with all this?
So I don't treat CLL patients. We use lenalidomide for other types of lymphomas, but it's all outside the indication. So we have a lot of clinical trials using lenalidomide. So the standard dose is usually 25 milligrams daily, 3 weeks out of 4 week cycle. And clearly it has activity in a wide variety of lymphoid malignancies. So it's in B-cell and T-cell lymphomas. But back to the CLL, yes, there's been reported cases. By itself is not an indication to treat everyone who's going to have lenalidomide with primary prophylaxis with rasburocase. You need to be aware of it. You should watch the patients, especially the first few days when they start on new therapy with lenalidomide. If you start having increase in uric acid, then you should treat them with rasburocase or other agents.
Are there any situations right now where you would use allopurinol?
So personally, short answer, no. That doesn't mean that you should not use it at all. I think most of the times, unless there's an underlying reason for elevated uric acid, or if you have a history of gout and so forth, because mild uric acid, you really don't need to treat it. I mean, if you have uric acid of 4 or 5, allopurinol, to me, it creates more, and that's personal opinion. I know that there's maybe disagreements on this. For leukemia, it's maybe more widely used. For lymphomas, I don't use it much. I either use hydration or the risperidase. In between, allopurinol can cause rash, can cause interaction with other medications, can cause neutropenia, can cause elevation of kidney functions. So to me, it complicates things more than help.
What about side effects, infusion reactions with risperidase? Do they occur?
So there's allergic reaction is described in patients with the 6-GDP, which is an inherited enzyme that is seen in mainly African-American and individuals of Mediterranean origin. It's very rare. Also, there's reported incidence of allergic reaction, especially in patients who have a history of severe asthma. Other than that, there's not much of a side effects with the drug. It's relatively safe.
Any questions that you have received from oncologists in practice about tumor lysis syndrome or risperidase that we haven't talked about?
I think the most common question is how many doses you need to give to patients. And that's because the label says 5 to 7 doses. But in practice, 2 to 3 is maximum what you need. And it's been validated through the expanded access program and so forth. So, and then the other thing is that when do you panic to give a second dose or third dose or fourth dose? And there's really no guideline for this. It's judgment call still. You need to watch the patient, see, you know, if the, let's say, after the first dose, the uric acid goes down to 0 after 4 hours. And the next day, it goes from 0 to 8. And then I would definitely give a second, especially when you're still actively giving chemotherapy in a rapidly responsive disease. And the other questions frequently asked, can I get away with reduced dose? Do I have to give the, you know, full prescribed dose? And then in the absence of really data, I don't like to deviate from the FDA-approved dosing, so I use the FDA-approved dose.
Let's talk a little bit about mantle cell, and if you could talk a little bit about the approach to the younger patient. There's been a lot of debate and controversy about R-hypercVAD versus R-CHOP followed by transplant. And there was a presentation by the NCCN at the ASH meeting, kind of from a registry, and I know MD Anderson had a lot of the patients in there. Can you talk about what they looked at and what your take is right now, and what do you say to docs who ask you, you know, how about treatment of these patients up front?
Right. So the problem with mantle cell lymphoma is that all the data so far is based on retrospective or small prospective non-randomized studies. So that generates a problem because most of what you hear is basically educated opinions, not data-driven. In the absence of randomized trials, what I do in my practice, I see that the Rituxan hypercVAD gives, as of today, the best outcome, even though I said in non-randomized trials. So patients who are younger than the age of 60, 65, I offer them R-hypercVAD as they tolerate it, as written, as published by our group from Dr. Romaguera. Older patients, different story, because yes, they do not tolerate the treatment well, and they don't do well with R-hypercVAD-based regimens. So I tend to give them something different, and there's different options for these patients. One of them is the straight R-hypercVAD with no methotrexate and IRC. This seems to be more tolerable for the older patients and do fine. Now, the role of transplant is still controversial. There's a couple of pieces of data to suggest that you can have options. One, you can give R-CHOP, and if you have remission, you can consolidate with autologous transplant and you do fine. And you do also preemptive rituximab, a sort of maintenance. This is what's been reported from Nordic group a couple of ashes ago. The second one, what we do right now, we give R-hypercVAD. We don't use autologous transplant unless the patient do not achieve remission. So if you achieve CR, we don't automatically refer the patient to transplant. What the NCCN report at ASH said, if your induction therapy is R-hypercVAD, you probably do better than other induction regimens if you want to end up having a transplant. Now, this is, again, database mining. What this may indicate that, yes, R-hypercVAD may induce higher response rate, higher CR rate, and therefore you have more patients going to transplant. But in the absence of randomized trials, I think we have options, like most of other lymphomas. R-CHOP followed by autologous transplant, it's fine. R-hypercVAD alone with no transplant, if you achieve CR, is fine for younger individuals.
What about clinical trials trying to incorporate bortezomib into upfront therapy? I've heard about, you know, trials looking at bortezomib incorporated into hypercVAD, bortezomib with R-CHOP and transplant. What are some of the specific issues being looked at there?
So bortezomib is one of the very few new agents been approved by the FDA for mantle cell lymphoma. Of course, it's approved for relapsed patients. About 40% response rate that lasts probably about 6 to 8 months. So it has single-agent activity in a good number of patients. So the natural progression then is to try to combine it with other active agents, and most people then would move it up front and combine it in phase 1, phase 2, and if there is tolerance and signal, then you go to randomized trial. So that's what we're seeing right now. So bortezomib is moved up front, R-CHOP, R-EPOCH, R-HyperCiva. These are the three probably most widely used regimens. Still, some of them in a phase 1, phase 2 fashion. Once they get the signal from the phase 2 trial showing that there's safety and good efficacy, then we have to do a randomized trial to show that there is benefit by adding bortezomib, but we're not there yet.
What do we know about the neuropathy associated with bortezomib and mantle cell, and particularly how it might be related to the schedule? In myeloma particularly, we've seen a lot of data in the last year suggesting a lot less neurotoxicity on the weekly schedule. Been some debate about whether it's efficacious in that schedule. It seems like maybe it is. What about in mantle cell?
Right, great question. So the way the bortezomib is approved as single agent is given the same way like we give it with multiple myeloma, day 1, 4, 8, 11, out of a 3-week cycle. When you combine it with chemotherapy, you can't do that. So usually you give only the day 1, day 4 out of a 21-day cycle. So we're giving almost half the dose of bortezomib, and therefore the neuropathy is not as substantial. However, keep in mind that we're combining it with some agent that may have on their own some neuropathy, like vincristine. And there have been some report that there may be a slight increase with the R-CHOP chemotherapy when it's given up front, but I think we need to wait and see what's the outcome in the phase 2 trials.
What's your experience been with neuropathy? What's the characteristics that you've observed and have been reported in trials, and how reversible is it?
So I've seen a wide range of neuropathy with bortezomib, and I've seen as bad as foot drops, where the patient cannot even drive, cannot feel the pedal, and this is the most severe form. And that's, we've seen this in mainly heavily pretreated patients, had multiple agents in the past, vincristine, platinum, and so forth, and also prolonged administration. That's when we were using single agent bortezomib in the relapse setting before the drug was approved. So we're giving the patient like several months because they really had no other options. We don't do that anymore. Now we're more aware of it. We don't wait until we have the severe neuropathy. And most of the time when it's mild, like the vincristine neuropathy, it's reversible. It may not normalize completely, but it may get improved with time.
How do you manage the patient with mantle cell who's older, you don't want to use an aggressive regimen?
So my preference, I use the R-HyperCVAD with no methotrexate RSC straight, so like give it every 3 weeks. I've used also the German FMCR, which is a fludarabine-based regimen. But I also use, depends again on the age, the underlying physical status, organ functions or dysfunction. You can even use rituximab alone if you want to, or rituximab thalidomide has been also used by some. This is outside the clinical trials. So there's options for these patients.
What about radioimmune therapy in mantle cell?
Radioimmune therapy has activity, as we reported. It's about 40% response rate, but is not approved by the FDA for this indication. It's difficult to get insurance to pay for it.
If you could get it paid for, what are the situations, if any, that you might consider it off study? I guess the one thing, it seems like it, you know, extends the duration of remission.
Right. So it's a phase 2 trial looking at the use of radioimmune therapy after R-CHOP chemotherapy, abbreviated cycles of R-CHOP, for frontline mantle cell lymphomas. And yes, you're absolutely correct. It can convert PRs to CRs and can also prolong the duration of remissions. We've used it as single agent in relapse setting, and from our own experience, patients with bulky disease are the patients who don't benefit most. You need to start with patients who have some disease relapse, less than 5 centimeters in largest diameter, so like low tumor bulk, and these are the patients who are likely to benefit from this treatment modality. We've seen patients who have been in remission for more than 6-9 months with this treatment.
What do we know about lenalidomide in mantle cell?
Yeah, lenalidomide is an interesting drug. It has an activity in wide range of lymphoid malignancies, including mantle cell lymphoma. It has about 30% single-agent activity in mantle cell lymphomas. And there's interest now in looking at potential approval in that indication, especially in either Velcade failures, or you can make a case to either combine it with Velcade or randomize against Velcade because it has good single-agent activity. But clearly, it has activity in mantle cell lymphomas. And there's trials now also trying to combine it with rituximab, like it's combining two biologic agents, non-toxic, non-chemotherapy-based agents.
I think when people think about mantle cell, they think of a aggressive disease that really requires aggressive therapy. But I've also heard people talk about a subset within mantle cell that seems to be more indolent. People talk about it being CLL-like. What do we know about that subset? How often does it occur? And, why does it occur? And how do you manage patients like that?
Well, so it's, again, another good question. I think it all depends on what patient you're seeing and what treatment you're using. And I gave you the example of Hodgkin lymphoma, where the survival used to be measured by 2 years. And now with these gentler agents that we've been using, yes, we're not curing patients, we're converting a cancer to a chronic status. And I think we're seeing the same thing for mantle cell lymphoma. Our knee-jerk reaction in the past was we give hyper-CVAD, you give autologous transplant, you give more intensive chemotherapy, and after an average of 3 regimens, the patient's burned out bridges, they have no platelets, no white cell counts, we're watching their tumor grow, and of course they die. So we used to call it very aggressive disease. And now we're getting a little bit more gentler, sort of like the multiple myeloma colleagues. We're seeing now more extended lifespan with multiple myeloma, because we're using more biologic agents up front, keeping the chemotherapy only when you need it. We're starting with lenalidomide, with bortezomib, with thalidomide, and we use the chemotherapy for later stages. And that's changed the natural history of myeloma already. The patients now used to have about 2.5 years of survival. Now you have like 6 years of survival. And I think we're following the same paradigm for mantle cell lymphoma. So it all depends on the treatment that you use in this patient population.